excerpting now the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James W. Douglas, published in softcover by 2008. And this is about a fellow called Air Force Sergeant Robert Vinson, who was on a plane that carried an Oswald double that flew out of Dallas, Texas, and then landed in Las Vegas. On his new assignment, Vinson, V-I-N-S-O-N, would soon learn that the CIA's projects out of Site 51 included experimental aircraft shaped like saucers. The same was true at the CIA's other base at Roswell, New Mexico, where the C-54 carrying the second Oswald had landed. Both Site 51 and Roswell were home to, quote, flying saucers, unquote, that people saw periodically in the area. They, in fact, came not from outer space, but from the CIA, which encouraged the flying saucer reports as a convenient cover story for U.S. experimental aircraft. The point being, the, quote, flying saucers, unquote, are real, and they don't come from outer space. And obviously, I think that many manifestations, such as the, quote, nine, unquote, and the Urantia cult, where we have your blonde-haired, blue-eyed space aliens or otherwise white space aliens who are superior to the blacks. That sounds very much of this world. Now, again, this program is untidy, and it is something of a reach, I realize. In For the Record program number 912, again, done in the summer of 2016, I took a look at the I.G. Farben successor companies, one of the key elements of the Borman Flight Capital Network, and they're buying up not only of companies that produce food, particularly for lower, middle, and working class people, but also pharmaceutical companies, and most importantly, Monsanto. Here is an excerpt from For the Record number 912. Every once in a while, I have to do a show that I'm sure many listeners will feel, oh my God, there goes Dave again. Man, is he out there, this stuff. And I can appreciate that. However, I have taken stock of some things in the past that are very alarming, and I'm looking at things that are taking place today, and I am thinking about what may happen in the future. And as blues singer Taj Mahal said, man, if you ain't scared, you ain't right. And what we're going to be looking at in this program is something of a potpourri. We are going to come back in a big way to the Borman Flight Capital Organization, about which I have spoken so often. Please download and read the book Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. His work was underwritten by CBS News. It was undertaken at the instigation of his friend and colleague Edward R. Murrow. CBS would not go with it. Numerous publishers would not go with it due to pressure from the Borman Group, including from the Thiessen industrial interests. Finally, Lyle Stewart published it. Lyle Stewart had both of his legs broken the week of publication. Ultimately, Paul Manning's son, Jerry, was murdered in retaliation for his continued work on the Borman Group. What we're going to be looking at concerns genetic engineering, a disturbing body of evidence that AIDS may have been deliberately produced and constitute the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare, because this disease, supposedly evolved from an African monkey virus, is such that only white people, and in fact only a certain percentage of purebred Northern Europeans, have a gene that affords hereditary immunity to infection by the HIV. It appears that this also provided immunity to the Black Death. Whether the Black Death was bubonic plague, as had been so long presumed, or was in fact an infectious viral caused hemorrhagic fever, similar in certain respects to Ebola, and that is the thinking at this point. The fact of the matter is that the gene that provides immunity to the AIDS virus also provided immunity to the Black Death. And we're going to be taking a look at that and the subject of genetic engineering and genetic modification of foods and what I believe is a growing pattern by the Borman Group of buying up food companies, in particular food companies that will be selling food to the hoi polloi, so to speak, to Mr. and Mrs. Average. We're going to begin by taking a look at an AP story from May 19th of 2016. Bayer takeover of Monsanto would create a global giant. Bayer's potential acquisition of Monsanto Company would create a giant seed and farm chemical company with a strong footprint in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, combining two businesses with complementary geographical focus. But Bayer might have to shed part of its business because of antitrust concerns. Note that for future reference. And the price tag on any deal would be huge. Monsanto's market value is around $42 billion. Germany-based Bayer said Thursday in a short statement that its executives had met recently with their Monsanto counterparts to privately discuss a negotiated acquisition, unquote, of the specialist in genetically modified crop seeds. So note that. And note also that, of course, Bayer was a major element of IG Farben. It is, as we are about to see, a major element of the Borman Capital Network and another of the companies that evolved out of the breakup of IG Farben at the end of World War II. And another major Borman company is the chemical company BASF. And BASF has actually been partnered with Monsanto in developing some of its GMOs. And as we are going to see, if in fact the combined Bayer-Monsanto has to shed corporate properties to meet antitrust deals, it may very well be that BASF buys those up, which would give two major Borman companies, both evolved from IG Farben, that would give them basically complete control or a dominant position in the global GMO market. This is a Bloomberg News story by Shenay, S-H-E-E-N-A-G-H, Matthews, and Andrew Mark, M-A-R-C, Noel, N-O-E-L, from May 19th of 2016. BASF is sleeping giant on deals as Bayer moves on Monsanto. It reads in part, with an aversion to overpaying and the conviction that a conglomerate approach is best, Germany's BASF SE has so far set out the biggest ever consolidation wave in the global crop chemicals and seeds industry. In the lead-up to Bayer AG's unsolicited takeover proposal for Monsanto Company on Thursday, Chief Executive Officer Kurt Bock, B-O-C-K, has talked up thrift balking at the price tags placed on assets. Rather than betting the farm on a big deal and challenging arch agrochemicals rival Bayer from Monsanto, Bock appears content to stay out of the fray, ready to selectively buy up any businesses that may come to the market in the dust of mega deals. In other words, if the Bayer-Monsanto deal does go through, BASF already partnered with Monsanto in their GMO projects may very well buy up those companies that are shed by Bayer-Monsanto, giving the old IG Farben and the Borman Network a very central dominant position in the GMOs market. What we're going to do now is to review a section of For the Record Program 576, specifically dealing with IG Farben, the genesis of the Borman Capital Network, and the functioning of IG Farben during World War II and as an extension of the Third Reich in the formation of the Bormann Capital Network. This from For the Record 576 and from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning.
At this meeting, described on page 25 of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Dr. Scheid, again, SS general and the personal representative of Martin Bormann at this meeting, discusses how the Third Reich is going to survive military defeat, and that is basically to rejoin the international corporate community and to utilize the connections between powerful German corporations and not only their subsidiaries abroad, but their cartel partners, including powerful American corporations, to survive. Dr. Scheid said, "The Battle of France is lost to Germany," he admitted, quoting Reichsleiter Bormann as his authority, "and now the defense of the Siegfried Line and Germany itself is the main problem. From now on, German industry must take steps in preparation for a post-war commercial campaign, with each industrial firm making new contacts and alliances with foreign firms. This must be done individually and without attracting any suspicion. However, the Nazi Party and the Third Reich will stand behind every firm with permissive and financial support." Skipping down. Dr. Scheid also affirmed the ground must now be laid on the financial level for borrowing considerable sums from foreign countries after the war, unquote. As an example of the kind of support that had been most useful to Germany in the past, Dr. Scheid cited the fact that, quote, "patents for stainless steel belong to the Chemical Foundation Incorporated of New York and the Krupp Company of Germany jointly, and that of the United States Steel Corporation, Carnegie, Illinois, American Steel and Wire, National Tube, etc., were thereby under an obligation to work with the Krupp concern." He also cited the Zeiss Company, the Leica Company, and the Hamburg America Line, parenthetically linked to the Bush family, as typical firms that had been especially effective in protecting German interests abroad. He gave New York addresses to the 12 men. Well, last time I checked, New York was in the United States. And later the afternoon of the August 10th, a smaller conference in the afternoon was presided over by Dr. Busse of the German Armaments Ministry. It was attended only by representatives of Hecko, Krupp, and Röckling. Dr. Busse restated Bormann's belief that the war was all but lost, but that it would be continued by Germany until certain goals to ensure the economic resurgence of Germany after the war had been achieved. He added that German industrialists must be prepared to finance the continuation of the Nazi Party, which would be forced to go underground just as had the Maquis in France, and the IG Farben firm was to be a key for the post-war capital resurgence of Germany. Skipping down yet again, IG Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Bormann in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with IG's Dr. von Schnitzler, Bormann asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general, and to IG in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG Farben would be so great that despite German defeat, IG in one way or another could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. They will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories, as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves. And it was, again, IG Farben's worldwide industrial infrastructure and espionage capabilities and the Nazi Party organization within German corporations abroad that were essential for the post-war capital flight, which became the Bormann Capital Network, and which led to ultimately the economic resurgence not only of Germany, but the post-war underground perpetuation of the Third Reich's power, albeit in an economic, not military, form. Still later, Paul Manning, in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, discusses the worldwide espionage and corporate infrastructure of IG Farben, how it was inextricably linked with the Nazi Party, and how in turn this was utilized for the post-war capital flight. IG Farben's NW7 office in Berlin compiled military and economic data on all countries for the Wehrmacht. This department was staffed with men of recognized ability in all branches of business and science. It was under the direction of Dr. Max Ilgner, nephew of Hermann Schmitz, IG's president, who was known throughout the industrial world as the master of financial camouflage, unquote. Farben had offices and representatives in 93 countries, and no social gathering of businessmen was too small to be covered by an NW7 representative whose reports on market conditions, factory installations, raw material supplies, and research were transmitted immediately to Berlin and Dr. Ilgner. In the United States, NW7 operated through the firm of Chemnico Incorporated, an American foreign subsidiary. Chemnico sent tremendous amounts of information ranging from photographs and blueprints to detailed descriptions of entire industrial complexes and secret processes. From the United States, the new method for production of isooctane used for motor fuels was obtained. A leading IG scientist has stated that this important process originated entirely with the Americans and had become known to us in detail in its separate stages, unquote. The process for producing tetraethyl lead, essential for the manufacture of aviation gasoline, was obtained by Farben in the same way. An IG official commenting on the importance of this acquisition stated, "Without lead tetraethyl, the present method of warfare would be unthinkable. The fact that since the beginning of the war we could produce lead tetraethyl is entirely due to the circumstances that shortly before the Americans had presented us with the production plans complete with experimental knowledge. Thus, the difficult work of development, we need only recall the poisonous property of lead tetraethyl, which caused many deaths in the United States, was spared us since we could take up the manufacture of this product together with all the experience that the Americans had gathered over long years," unquote. By the way, the story of that and how IG Farben helped Germany get tetraethyl lead and other technologies is discussed at length in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 and For the Record program number 511.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing more about IG Farben's infrastructure. To be sure, IG's own research facilities produced many a scientific breakthrough for the Third Reich. Its experts developed the noted Buna process for the manufacture of synthetic rubber, freeing Germany from dependence on natural rubber. It developed the hydrogenation process for making motor fuels and lubricating oils from coal. Germany's shortage of bauxite, the raw material essential to manufacture aluminum, was surmounted by its developments in utilizing the element magnesium. This was a time of stockpiling. What NW7 could not purloin, IG's board of directors asked for under cartel agreements with other international firms. In one instance, it purchased 500 tons of lead for production of high-grade aviation gasoline obtained by a Farben Swiss subsidiary from the Ethyl Export Corporation of America. As it made such purchases on the world market in the late 30s, Farben continued to produce and stockpile everything useful to the German armed forces. Of 43 major products by Farben, 28 were primary needs of war makers. IG made all the synthetic rubber in Germany, all the methanol, the serums, and the lubricating oils. IG provided 95% of the poisonous gases, as well as over 90% of the nickel and plastics. 88% of the magnesium derivatives used by the Luftwaffe in its aircraft and incendiary bombs came from Farben, as did most of the nitrogen and explosives for the flying bombs in the V-2s. No other German war industry could have functioned without Farben's raw materials and technical assistance. This huge organization functioned as a manufacturing and research arm of the German government, with the responsibility of discovering all possible means of increasing the military power of Germany. More than 4.25 billion Reichsmarks was invested in new plants, mines, and power installations, with other millions going into new research facilities. Skipping down, so close had Farben become to the government that IG always knew in advance all invasions planned by Hitler. It was to supply the materials necessary to each conquest and when a land had been overrun and subjugated, the Farben experts would handle the consolidation and organization of the industrial facilities as additional supply sources for the German armed forces. As German troops swept across Europe and Hitler proclaimed his vision of a thousand-year Reich, IG Farben also dreamed of world empire. This was outlined with clarity in a document called New Ordnung, or New Order, that was accompanied by a letter of transmittal to the Ministry of Economics. It declared that a new order for the chemical industry of the world should supplement Hitler's new order. Therefore, the document stated, Farben was fitting future industrial plans into such a framework, i.e. a new world order for the chemical industry, paralleling and directly growing out of Hitler's new world order. Skipping down. The close relationship of Farben to the Third Reich leadership was underscored in other ways. IG's leading officials assisted in the formulation and execution of economic policies of government. Its president was a member of the Reichstag, its leading scientist was a chief assistant to Hermann Goering under the four-year plan. Its statisticians and economists prepared intelligence for the Nazi high command. Scores of its technicians were at any given time on loan to the air and war ministries. Skipping down, the contact men of NW7 throughout the world were called the IG Verbundungsmänner, the liaison officers between IG Farben back in Germany and the branches elsewhere. These IG Verbindungsmänner, as well as the other key Farben representatives working beyond the borders of the Third Reich, were members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Their loyalty to Hitler and to the New Order was uncompromising. Skipping down again. So now, Martin Bormann had at his command not only the Auslandsorganisation, but also the IG Verbundungsmänner of Farben, which could be counted on to heed his orders when it was time to disperse the commercial assets of the Third Reich. And chief among those were the assets of IG Farben. And as you can see in the description for the Record 305 and in reading the book itself, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Hermann Schmitz and the other elements of the IG were of great use to Martin Bormann in the Flight Capital Program. Talking about what took place after World War II, by the way, Manning's book was published in 81, the economic unification of West Germany is complete, and if there is any doubt in Europe who in the long run won the peace, there is none whatsoever among the former German leaders dwelling in South America. It is a good bet that if IG Farben's Hermann Schmitz were alive today, he would bear witness as to who really won the war. Schmitz died contented, having witnessed the resurgence of IG Farben, albeit in altered corporate forms, a money machine that continues to generate profits for all the old IG shareholders, an enormous international power for the German cadre directing the workings of the successor firms. To all appearances, Schmitz died in relatively reduced circumstances in 1960 at the age of 79, though immensely wealthy during his lifetime. Any information about his fortune seemingly vanished with his death, but those who know him believe it still exists. He was the master manipulator, the corporate and financial wizard, the magician who could make money appear and disappear and reappear again. His whole existence was leisure domain played out on the game board of IG Farben in his beloved Germany. The son of poor parents, born in Essen in 1981, a loner who made it to the top through ability, diligence, hard work, and singleness of purpose, he resembled Martin Bormann, who likewise had more than just a feel for mathematics but never went beyond high school and had to make it on his own. Their association was close and trusting over the years, and it is the considered opinion of those in their circle that the wealth possessed by Hermann Schmitz was shifted to Switzerland and to South America and placed in trust with Bormann, the legal heir to Hitler. Schmitz's wealth, largely IG Farben bearer bonds, converted to the big three successor firms, shares in Standard Oil of New Jersey equal to those held by the Rockefellers, General Motors, and other U.S. blue-chip industrial stocks, and the 700 secret companies controlled in his time by IG, as well as shares in the 750 corporations he helped Martin Bormann establish during the last year of World War II, has increased in all segments of the modern industrial world. The Bormann Organization in South America utilizes the voting power of the Schmitz Trust, along with their own assets, to guide the multinationals they control as they keep steady the economic course of the fatherland. And still more about I.G. Farben and its post-war resurgence. Skipping down once again. By 1956, the three major multinationals, Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer, reshaped from the 159 companies within Germany that had comprised IG Farben, were generating record profits for the original 450 major Farben stockholders, who had organized themselves into the IG Farben Stockholders Protective Committee in Bonn. The big three went on expanding, tripling capitalization in 1956 from investment funds that poured in from the interlocking companies established in safe haven companies by Martin Bormann and Hermann Schmitz. There was a return more vigorous than ever of the huge, monolithic industrial multinationals that dominated the German economy before and during World War II. Each of these three spin-offs from IG Farben today does more business individually than did Farben at its zenith when its corporate structure covered 93 countries. BASF and Bayer individually boast worldwide sales of nearly $10 billion annually, while Hoechst, now the world's largest chemical company, generated $16.01 billion in worldwide sales in 1980. Each does more business than E.I. DuPont de Nemours with sales of $9.4 billion. Skipping down. Together, these three multinationals assure permanent prosperity for the original 450 Farben stockholders, their banks, and the shadowy shareholders of the Bormann Organization in South America who guard and vote the Hermann Schmitz Trust Fund through intermediaries at the annual meetings of BASF, Bayer, and Hoechst. And, of course, the schemes of economic control that were so carefully crafted by people like Hermann Schmitz and Martin Bormann and others for the post-war revival of the German economy exist to this day, and the available evidence suggests very strongly that they control Citgo, consequently, also Smartmatic, and also Sequoia. And of the Bormann Capital Organization's position astride German industry and through the international cartel system, the rest of the world, atop an organizational, but this is from Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Bormann is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, the chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Skipping down. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann Organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann.
Now, again, from For the Record, 576.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, in For the Record 305, dealing with the Bormann Flat Capital Network, we began the program with an article from the Wall Street Journal. It talks about what they call the Nazi money trail. Of particular interest, although most of this will be either supplemental or review, Note the company Becker GmbH. That was a food company, a grain company, I believe, put together by an SS officer with monies that were confiscated from Holocaust victims. Now, eventually, that company, again, Becker GmbH, was bought out. It is now part of ConAgra Foods, a major food producer that produces foodstuffs that are largely consumed by the lower, middle, and working classes. In other words, they don't produce haute cuisine. When the Borman Network does a deal, for example, when a Borman company, and we can assume that Becker GmbH would have been under the supervision of the Borman Network, when they become part of another company, that happens in exchange for either stock percentage, either they gain major stock holdings in the new company, and or a position on the board of directors, often both. And we can safely assume that there is a Borman input into ConAgra. So before we move on to what I call food for thought, let's listen to this short excerpt from For the Record 305 from 1997.
We're going to begin with our examination of the reality of the Nazi flight capital program with a Wall Street Journal article from April 28th of 1997. This was researched for us by a listener. This is an article entitled, Nazi Money Trail Heats Up 50 Years Later, subtitled, Banks and Nations Are Opening Treasure Trove of Records. It's by Greg Steinmetz of the Wall Street Journal, and it reads in part as follows. According to testimony after World War II, an SS officer named Kurt Becker, B-E-C-H-E-R, collected millions of dollars in gold, banknotes, and jewels from Jews seeking to buy their freedom from the Nazis. After the war, Colonel Becker built a successful Bremen-based grain company, Becker GmbH, now owned by ConAgra Incorporated of the U.S. Much of the ransom money was never found, according to the Nazi-hunting Simon Wiesenthal Center. Colonel Becker's name is on a list of 234 powerful Germans the Los Angeles-based Wiesenthal Center believes stashed money abroad during the war. It has asked banks in former Nazi havens such as Argentina to open their books and come clean on the Nazi accounts. Quote, you can't have closure until you investigate the perpetrator's account, says Wiesenthal President Rabbi Marvin Heyer. As the fight over Nazi gold intensifies, bringing forth new details on the complicity of supposedly neutral countries with the Germans, the bank matter highlights just how much is still unknown about the Third Reich money trail. Despite a half century of research by historians, it still isn't clear what happened to much of the billions of dollars worth of gold, jewelry, cash, and artworks plundered by the Nazis to finance the war and line their own pockets. And skipping down, one of the central elements in the Nazi flight capital program, as well as the remarkable post-war Borman organization, about which we will speak in a minute, were some of the neutral countries and indeed some of the corporations that were deeply involved through cartel agreements and standard business arrangements with the major German corporations that underlay the financial and military power of the Third Reich. By the way, I've talked about the incalculably important American corporate connections to Nazism and fascism in numerous programs, including the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, among others. Continuing with this Wall Street Journal article, one of the more complicated gold transactions involved Sweden's wealthy Wallenberg family. After the war started, the Wallenbergs secretly agreed to take over the U.S. arm of Germany's Bosch AG, now known as Robert Bosch GmbH, with the condition that Bosch could buy it back later. American Bosch Corporation in Springfield, Massachusetts, made electronic parts for the U.S. military and thus served as a, quote, kind of intelligence service, unquote, for its German parent, says Dutch writer Gerald Alders, capital A-L-D-E-R-S. Seeing through the arrangement, U.S. officials seized the company in 1942. Bosch bought back the stock to free itself of interest payments promised the Wallenbergs, using Reichsbank gold to pay for it, according to documents unearthed by Swedish journalists. And skipping down, of the Nazi flight capital program, this article alludes to a critical meeting that took place in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine in August of 1944, and that will be our point of departure for the discussion of the remarkable Borman organization. After it became clear that Germany would lose the war, top Nazis began preparing for a comeback and plotting ways to pay for it. A French double agent who spoke to the Allies claimed that officials from Rheinmetall AG, Krupp AG, now known as Fried Krupp AG Hesch Krupp, Messerschmitt AG, Volkswagen AG, and other companies met at a Strasbourg hotel in August of 1944 to discuss financing plans for the Fourth Reich.
That again from For the Record 305 from 1997. Note again that Becker GmbH became part of ConAgra. That would only have happened if the Bormann Group got stock holdings, a stock percentage in ConAgra, and or a seat or two on the board of directors. The point being that there are undoubtedly Bormann corporate links to ConAgra.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I want to note the following. A Brazilian businessman whose profile suggests very strongly that he is a major functionary of the Bormann network. He is Brazil's richest man. He resides in Switzerland, and he is a major investor. Not only is in charge of Budweiser, but also many other food brands, including Heinz and Company that supplies McDonald's, among other restaurants, and Burger King. His name is Jorge Paulo Lehmann, L-E-M-A-N-N. That's a nice Iberian name, isn't it? L-E-M-A-N-N. I profiled him in Forbes, May 27th of this year. Jorge Paulo Lehmann is Brazil's richest man thanks to his stake in Anheuser-Busch InBev, the world's largest brewer, which he owns through private equity firm 3G Capital, together with fellow billionaires and longtime partners Carlos Sicopira and Marcel Herrmann, H-E-R-R-M-A-N-N, another nice Iberian name, Teles, T-E-L-L-E-S. The trio also has stakes in Restaurant Brands International, which owns Burger King, and Tim Hortons, and is listed on both the New York and Toronto stock exchanges. In 2013, Lehmann's private equity firm bought H.J. Heinz and Company for $23 billion, together with Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. It was 3G Capital's second acquisition of an American name brand. In 2010, 3G Capital bought Burger King in a leveraged buyout. Again, noting companies like Heinz, Burger King, and others. Once again, these are major food companies that whose clientele are largely middle class, lower middle class, and working class people, people who consume fast food or things like ready-made, you know, microwave macaroni and cheese and other things. And this is not to pass judgment, but again, noting, and I can appreciate this will appear to be something of a reach, noting the probability that this Brazil's richest man, as he is described in Forbes, is part of the Bormann network, and in combination with Monsanto, with Bayer and BASF, a position to gobble up Monsanto, and with things like Becker GmbH being absorbed into ConAgra. I'm looking at the underground Reich basically buying up food supplies, in particular food that would be marketed to working class people. What we're going to do now is to jump back once again to 2007, and we're going to listen to a portion of For the Record 606 dealing with AIDS and the fact that a portion of purebred Northern Europeans, a.k.a. Aryans, have a hereditary immunity to that.
One of the books that we utilized in AFA 16 was a book called A Higher Form of Killing, co-authored by Robert Harris and Jeremy Paxman. In the original Hill and Wang softcover edition published in 1982, there is a passage which was deleted when the book was republished in 2002 by Random House. Random House is now owned by Bertelsmann, the publishing house of the SS. It is now the largest English language publisher. what is contained in the book A Higher Form of Killing right at the end of the 1982 edition is some rumination about the possible development of a new type of disease-causing organism. And we're going to read first from text from The Higher Form of Killing, and in turn that excerpts a bit of testimony from a Dr. MacArthur in a House subcommittee hearing that was drawing up the defense budget for fiscal year 1969 and 70. So what you're about to hear was something that was said on the floor of Congress in the hearings, basically in 1969. As long ago as 1962, quoting now from A Higher Form of Killing, beginning again, as long ago as 1962, 40 scientists were employed at the U.S. Army Biological Warfare Laboratories on full-time genetics research. Many others, it was said, appreciate the implications of genetics for their own work. The implications were made more specific that genetic engineering could solve one of the major disadvantages of biological warfare, that it is limited to diseases which occur naturally somewhere in the world. And then the quote from Dr. MacArthur. Now again, this is a doctor testifying in front of a House subcommittee that was drawing up the defense budget for fiscal year 1969 and 70. Dr. MacArthur said in 1969, "Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new, infective microorganism which could differ in certain important respects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease." And, of course, refractory, it can mean resistant to, it can also mean breaking down, just as a prism refracts light, breaks it down into its component spectra. Then the authors, now bear in mind that was said in 1969, and of course AIDS first made its appearance to the general public anyway, in exactly that time period. The authors, Paxman and Harris, in 1982 went on to comment, "The possibility that such a supergerm may have been successfully produced in a laboratory somewhere in the world in the years since that assessment was made is one which should not be too readily cast aside." No, indeed. And, in For the Record program number 16, we looked at evidence that, in fact, that program did get funded, and lo and behold, a disease unlike any other appeared, a disease that breaks down, a sexually transmitted disease that destroys the immune system. We're going to talk about some of the many strange aspects of AIDS, in particular the epidemiology, later on in the program. But what we're going to do now is to review a curious aspect of this disease. I should mention that AIDS, that it depends on what source one checks, but it was supposedly an African monkey virus that had existed in Africa for years. And then it was first detected very strangely among gays in 3 North American cities, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. The notion that a disease as deadly as AIDS, basically you get it, you're dead, could have existed in a part of the world where people's health and their immune systems in particular were already compromised by bad diet, inadequate medical care, or other systemic infections or parasites, as is the case in Africa, and would not have been noticed is just a bit much. It strains the credibility. One of the very strange things about AIDS, again, supposedly a monkey virus that jumped to humans, one of the very strange things about AIDS is that there is a hereditary immunity to HIV infection. But that gene is a recessive one. It is only present in the white race. No other racial group has it. And according to some sources, it is only available basically that it is peculiar to Northern Europeans, quote, Aryans, unquote. Certainly, this particular hereditary trait is present only in white people, and according to some sources, present only in purebred Northern Europeans or Aryans. Medical people and scientific people that I've mentioned this to have it was very strange. They actually laughed, not ha-ha laughter, but laughter in the sense of what Nietzsche said when he observed that, quote, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. Scientific and medically qualified people that I've discussed this with have, not a lot of them, but without exception, they have viewed that as extremely suspicious and, in fact, indicative of the fact that AIDS was deliberately created. Nature is not going to do something like that. Here's an African monkey virus which mutates, becomes a deadly human scourge, but purebred Northern Europeans, or white people, just happen to have a hereditary immunity to it. It's the Aryan virus. That particular hereditary immunity appears to have also conferred limited immunity from the bubonic plague on the individuals who have it. And we're going to revisit a bit of research that we looked at in For the Record 472. In turn, we're going to access some information from the PBS.org website. It's called Secrets of the Dead, Case File, Mystery of the Black Death. And I'm going to reread some information about the CCR5 Delta 32 mutation. This is a mutation present only in white people and, according to some sources, only in purebred Northern Europeans, or, quote, Aryans, unquote, that confers basically freedom from infection by bubonic plague and AIDS. Reading now from Secrets of the Dead, Case File, Mystery of the Black Death. In September of 1665, George Vickers, a tailor in the small central England village of Eyam, E-Y-A-M, received a parcel of cloth ridden with plague-infected fleas from London. 4 days later, Vickers died. By the end of the month, 5 more villagers had succumbed to the plague. The panicked town turned to their rector, William Montbassant, who persuaded them to quarantine the entire village to prevent the bacterium from spreading throughout the region. It seemed like suicide. A year later, the first outsiders ventured into Eyam expecting to find a ghost town. Yet, miraculously, half the town had survived. How did so many villagers live through the most devastating disease known to man? Local Eyam lore tells befuddling stories of plague survivors who had close contact with the bacterium but never caught the disease. Elizabeth Hancock buried 6 children and her husband in a week, but never became ill. The village gravedigger handled hundreds of plague-ravaged corpses, but survived as well. Could these people have somehow been immune to the Black Death? Dr. Stephen O'Brien of the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., suggests they were. His work with HIV and the mutated form of the gene CCR called Delta 32 led him to Eyam. In 1996, research showed that Delta 32 prevents HIV from entering human cells and infecting the body. O'Brien thought this principle could be applied to the plague bacterium, which affects the body in a similar manner. To determine whether the Eyam plague survivors may have carried Delta 32, O'Brien tested the DNA of their modern descendants. What he found out was startling. And skipping down. For a disease-causing microorganism to infect the human body, there must be a gateway or portal through which it enters into human cells. The plague bacterium works this way, hijacking the white blood cells sent to eliminate it. Traveling inside the white blood cells to the lymph nodes, the bacteria break out and attack the focal point of the human immune system. Dr. Stephen O'Brien felt that the mutated CCR5 gene Delta 32 may have prevented the plague from being able to enter its host's white blood cells, unquote. And bear in mind, too, that it also appears to function that way with regard to AIDS. Continuing, Eyam provided O'Brien an ideal opportunity to test this theory. Specifically, Eyam was an isolated population known to have survived a plague epidemic. Everyone in the town would have been exposed to the bacterium, so it's likely that any life-saving genetic trait would have been possessed by each of these survivors. Like a Xerox machine, unquote, says O'Brien, their gene frequencies have been replicated for several generations without a lot of infusion from outside, unquote, thus providing a viable pool of survivor descendants who would have inherited such a trait. DNA samples could only be collected from direct descendants of the plague survivors. DNA is the principal component of chromosomes, which carry the genes that transmit hereditary characteristics. We inherit our DNA from our parents. Thus, I Am resident Joan Plant, for instance, may have inherited the Delta 32 mutation from one of her ancient relatives. Plant can trace her mother's lineage back 10 generations to the Blackwell siblings, Francis and Margaret, who both lived through the plague to the turn of the century. The next step was to harvest a DNA sample from Joan and the other descendants. DNA is found in the nuclei of cells. The amount is consistent in all typical cells, regardless of the size or function of that cell. One of the easiest methods of obtaining a DNA tissue sample is to take a cheek or buccal swab. Note the following passage. After 3 weeks of testing at the University College in London, Delta 32 had been found in 14% of the samples. This is a genetically significant percentage, yet what really did it mean? Could the villagers have inherited Delta 32 from elsewhere, residents who had moved to the community in the 350 years since the plague? Was this really a higher percentage than anywhere else? To find out, O'Brien assembled an international team of scientists to test for the presence of Delta 32 around the world. Quote, "Native Africans did not have Delta 32 at all," O'Brien says. "And when we looked at East Asians and Indians, they were also flat zero. In fact, the levels of Delta 32 found in Iam were only matched in regions of Europe that had been affected by the plague and in America, which was for the most part settled by European plague survivors and their descendants." Now, again, as mentioned at the very outset of this particular passage that I've been reading, the CCR5 Delta 32 provides immunity to, basically provides protection against infection by AIDS. Again, reviewing as we course into what I'm about to read, from this same passage. In 1996, research showed that Delta 32 prevents HIV from entering human cells and infecting the body. It also apparently conferred immunity to those who had the CCR5 Delta 32. It can provide immunity to the plague as well. Returning to the passage we were just reading, "Native Africans did not have Delta 32 at all," O'Brien says, "and when we looked at East Asians and Indians, they were also flat zero. In fact, the levels of Delta 32 found in Iam were only matched in regions of Europe that had been affected by the plague and in America, which was for the most part settled by European plague survivors and their descendants." Meanwhile, recent work with another disease strikingly similar to plague, AIDS, suggests O'Brien was on the right track. HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, tricks the immune system in a similar manner as the plague bacterium, targeting and taking over white blood cells. Virologist Dr. Bill Paxson at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York City noticed, quote, "The center had no study of people who were exposed to HIV, but who had remained negative," unquote. He began testing the blood of high-risk HIV-negative individuals like Steve Krohn, C-R-O-H-N, exposing their blood to 3,000 times the amount of HIV normally needed to infect a cell. Steve's blood never became infected. "We thought maybe we had infected the culture with bacteria or whatever," says Paxton. "So we went back to Steve, but it was the same result. We went back again and again. Same result," unquote. Paxton began studying Crohn's DNA and concluded there was some sort of blocking mechanism preventing the virus from binding to his cells. Further research showed that the mechanism was Delta 32. Scientists studying HIV first learned about the gateway blocking capacity of the CCR5 mutation in 1996. Several drug companies then quickly began exploring the possibility of developing pharmaceuticals that would mimic Delta 32 by binding to CCR5 and blocking the attachment of HIV. So basically, this CCR5 Delta 32 mutation, a recessive one, conferred basically freedom from infection by the plague and also AIDS. It is only present in white people. No other racial group has it. And according to the allegations in some more information that's contained in For the Record of 472, it isn't just white people, it's purebred, quote, Aryans, unquote, or Northern Europeans. Now, a caveat in the web entry here, the web posting that I'm going to excerpt here, there is no sourcing for this. Now, obviously, one has to approach anything on the internet with great caution. The internet is an open medium, and an awful lot of what's on there is complete BS, because there's absolutely no there's no regulatory device of any kind on the internet. So one always wants to be careful with information that is disseminated via the internet. There is no sourcing of what this person is maintaining about the CCR5 Delta 32. I'd be interested to see if the literature itself does indeed corroborate what this person is maintaining. From Aryan Genes Immune to Death from AIDS, we read, "This is the nightmare of AIDS no one wants to believe. As we come closer to celebrating on December 1st, yet another World AIDS Day, let's take a good hard look at what's really going on before we pour more of our ever-diminishing, hard-earned money down yet another horrendous sinkhole. It has been found that some Caucasians who have tested positive for the HIV virus were found to take a very long time to actually develop full-blown AIDS, as they call it. It has since been discovered, since 1997, that 20% of European Caucasians have the so-called Aryan, unquote, genetic disposition. If both your parents, in other words, are of Aryan descent, it appears you can never die of AIDS, even though you might be infected. The reason for this is in the genetic coding of the killer T cells, which are part of the body's immune system's protective shield. These are the cells which are attacked by HIV, by the HIV retrovirus. The location of the attack has been discovered. It is on the CCR5 gene in the third DNA gene pair. The particular location is the Delta 32 receptor site. If either of your DNA pairs from either your mother or father is Delta 32 positive, then HIV virus can attach itself at that point. If you are Delta 32 negative, then HIV just floats around in your blood harmlessly for you. But even though you may be Delta 32 negative at both sites, you can supposedly still spread the virus. What has been discovered is that these 20% of European Caucasians are members of the Aryan gene pool. Also, it has been discovered that the farther north you go in Europe, say in Norway, Finland, Sweden, etc., you find the highest percentage of people that are Delta 32 negative at the CCR5 gene allele. That this would be a simple coincidence is beyond all human reason. Parenthetically, the scientific and medically qualified people that to whom I spoke had this same reaction. Beginning again, that this would be a simple coincidence is beyond all human reason. To say that HIV suddenly crawled out of the woodwork in Central Africa by someone being bitten by a green tree monkey is one thing, but then to say that the only human gene pool on Earth that is immune to HIV is the Aryan race is a coincidence that even Howdy Doody wouldn't buy. What we are looking at is a genocide perpetrated on racial groups of the world that makes the Nazi Holocaust look like romper room. Add to that the global trafficking in drugs that specifically target minorities, the poor, and people of color. And while it may not look like the Holocaust during World War II, it doesn't have to. The AIDS epidemic isn't a mysterious virological disease, it is calculated murder, and a genocide that is beyond human comprehension. And since it is the venerated Aryan race that is immune to it, then one has to assume that they are the ones who promulgated it.
Again, with AIDS in all probability having been genetically engineered, and with the Underground Reich having access to that information, the thing that I am concerned about is the possibility of basically using food marketed worldwide as a vector for eliminating selective ethnic groups using genetic engineering and genetically engineered binary pathogens. And trafficked around in the food. We will see. I know this is a reach, but sometimes I have to do that. This concludes, For the Record, 912 Food for Thought, being recorded on May 27th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Harvey Appetite.